The next case is 2022-1482, in the matter of the State of Ohio versus Wilson. Good morning, Ms. Bowling.
Good morning, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors. If I may, I'd like to reserve up to 3 minutes for rebuttal, please. Your Honors, Tyler Wilson is serving a 16 to 20 year sentence as a result of conviction, as this court is well aware, of one count of felonious assault with pendant gun specifications. We're asking that this court reverse the second district decision that held that Mr. Wilson's trial counsel was not ineffective, and underlying that decision on whether or not Mr. Wilson's trial counsel was ineffective is the question presented to this court, and that is, what are the parameters of what a defendant must testify to or admit in order to garner or gain a self-defense instruction. Since 2019, with the burden shift, the requirement to gain a self-defense instruction is only that the defendant present some evidence, or that some evidence rather is presented, which tends to show that self-defense is an issue. That tends to show language is a low bar relative to where the burden has otherwise been set at preponderance standards. In Mr. Wilson's case, he did introduce evidence through his own testimony that tended to show that self-defense was an issue.
Well, wasn't his argument that he fired a warning shot?
Thank you for the question, Your Honor. His argument was that he fired a shot in defense of himself and his passenger. Those were his words.
Well, didn't he say it was a warning shot?
I don't believe Mr. Wilson used the word warning shot, but he did testify that the shot was intended to scare Reffitt, who was his aggressor. And so the term warning shot has been used through the briefing, and in essence, it was a warning shot according to his testimony. And so the question then becomes,
if he legitimately fired a shot not at someone but just to scare them, that doesn't meet the elements of the crime.
Well, Your Honor, actually, there is case law which lays out when firing a shot at or near someone, even if it doesn't strike them, would constitute felonious assault. And it goes to the knowing element of firing that shot, knowing meaning it could probably cause or would probably cause a certain result.
And isn't the definition of knowingly regardless of purpose? So if his purpose was to actually hit him or fire a warning shot, if he did it, a finder of fact could find that that element of knowingly was met.
And I agree with you, Your Honor.
Well, where was the shot fired?
The shot was fired within the window of the aggressor Reffitt's vehicle. A review of the record shows that these vehicles were window to window, with the aggressor, or the victim in this case, being in a truck, which was elevated higher than defendant Wilson's
vehicle. But Mr. Wilson fired it at him.
He fired
that direction, not up in the air, not...
That's right.
Okay, so it could have hit him.
Absolutely. Yes, Your Honor. He fired it at him. And interestingly, notably, I believe, Mr. Wilson's testimony was that he fired it, that it all happened very quickly, and that's very, very common with these self-defense cases and the testimony that comes out in them, that he fired it so very quickly, and the parties were so close to each other that he had to figure it probably couldn't have gone anywhere else, speaking to other than at or in the vehicle where the other driver sat.
You say it couldn't have gone anywhere else, it meaning the bullet?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
So there were four people who were witnesses to this shooting, and but only two people testified at trial, Reffitt, the victim, mm-hmm. and Wilson, the defendant, and ultimately trial counsel for the defense said Yes, that's correct. There's no self-defense here. So I know you're arguing that the latter is ineffective assistance, but what about the lack of other witnesses besides the two people who was like, he said, he said?
Case law establishes, Your Honor, that is enough to garner a self-defense instruction, that the instruction can come and can be given if there is evidence which, if believed, tends to show. And so what that means is that in determining whether or not a defendant gets this instruction, essentially, you almost have to look at it, the evidence presented in a light most favorable to the defendant, or look at it as if that evidence were going to be believed by
but
the trier.
My question is, was it ineffective assistance not to put the other two witnesses who actually witnessed the shooting on the stand?
Potentially, yes. However, the evidence that was put on, the testimony of Mr. Wilson himself, was in and of itself enough to garner the self-defense instruction.
And do I understand clearly from the transcript that he shot up toward the truck not just in an attempt to scare Reffitt, but to get him to back off?
To get him to back off, yes. We use the word repel, to repel the attack of his aggressor. And to get him to back off, yes, were Mr. Wilson's words.
And, okay, thank you.
The state seemed to be of the position that in order to garner or earn a self-defense instruction, that a defendant must admit explicitly to each and every element of the charged offense before the defendant is owed that instruction. However, there are circumstances in which that would be impossible or nearly impossible to earn a self-defense instruction. For example, if the charge is aggravated murder and one of the elements of that charge is premeditation or pre-planning, I cannot imagine a scenario where a defendant would be able to admit to each and every element of that offense and then make a justification of self-defense. And so, as the statute reads, self-defense presumes the intentional use of force. By firing his weapon, Mr. Wilson was intentionally using force. And what the Second District has done is relied on the series of cases that involve accident to support its decision that Mr. Wilson wasn't entitled to this instruction. We would urge this court that accident cases are a separate category entirely that are contradictory to the very notion of self-defense because there is no intentional use of force. Accident presumes that there is no act committed at all. And all of the cases on which the Second District relied have this underlying fact pattern of accident, where a defendant is saying there is an accidental discharge of a weapon during a scuffle, during an incident involving the two, and there is no intentional firing of that weapon, which is clearly distinct from the testimony that Mr. Wilson gave at trial. So self-defense concedes that a defendant had a purpose to commit the act but claimed that the act is justified. We would submit to this court that conceding a purpose to commit the act is not equivalent to admitting to each and every fact alleged by the state or to each and every element necessarily, although I believe in this case the testimony given by Mr. Wilson does meet that knowing element for the reasons that we have previously discussed, the proximity of these two gentlemen when the weapon was fired, the direction in which he fired, and the purpose for which he fired that weapon. Although there is case law that establishes that strategy decisions should not be second-guessed or interrupted on appeal, I would urge this court that a full reading of this record reveals that the acquiescence of trial counsel to the judge's opinion that this was not, quote, a self-defense case, or that a self-defense instruction was not warranted, was ineffective assistance. And there is case law that establishes, cited in my brief, that the failure to request a self-defense instruction where one is justified or earned is ineffective assistance of counsel. So the second prong of Strickland then becomes Was that deficient performance prejudicial to the defendant? Did it lead to either an unjust result or an unreliable result?
Did defense counsel make any objections during the trial?
None that I recall. None meaningfully that I recall. And this was a one-day, few hours at that trial. The questioning was very, very limited. There were no jury instructions that were requested. And I believe that the lack of development of this testimony is very apparent from the record also, and I believe that that lack of development of testimony is what has landed us all here.
Thank you.
Yes. The second prong of Strickland is met in this case. Mr. Wilson was prejudiced by the lack of a defense instruction. If you look at the closing arguments in this case, his trial counsel, Mr. Wilson's trial counsel, argues on one hand this was not self-defense, but then argues that it was self-defense. I believe his closing line in his argument is that the defendant, Mr. Wilson, fired, quote, in defense of himself and his passenger. That's what he left the jury with. However, that was without the benefit of a self-defense instruction. And because of that, the jury had nowhere to go. It's our position that with the benefit of a self-defense instruction, that the outcome of this case would likely have been very different. At minimum, it can be said that the outcome of this case as it stands is unreliable because of the confusion of the arguments of self-defense and because the jury did not have the benefit of that instruction. And I am almost to rebuttal time, and so if there are no questions at this point, I'll reserve that remainder. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Sorg.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Christian Sorg, and I'm representing the state and State v. Wilson. First, Wilson's trial counsel was not ineffective for deciding not to request a self-defense jury instruction. And second, Wilson was not entitled to such an instruction because he failed to satisfy his burden of production.
Which burden of production did he fail to satisfy? Which aspect?
The burden in 2901.05.
Right, but what aspect of the self-defense instruction?
Yes, Your Honor. So he did not present any evidence that tends to suggest that he acted in self-defense.
But he said he did. I mean, and there was a situation where there's clearly an altercation between these two people. What else would have been his motive for firing a shot at him, at Reffitt?
Well, Your Honor, neither party testified that he acted in self-defense. He testified that,
what evidence is missing from the record? I think she's
right. Yes, Your Honor. So to be entitled to a jury instruction, the court must have found that a reasonable jury could believe that Raffet pointed a gun at Wilson and also believe that Wilson did try to hit Raffet. So he...
Well, but where is that in the statute that you have to try to hit?
Yes, Your Honor. So
that you have to try to cause harm to your aggressor.
Yes, Your Honor. So this is... There's a preliminary that this is an affirmative defense. So in order for this to be... even get to the burden of production, he first must admit the elements of the crime, or at least not deny them.
Well, what elements have to be admitted and what was denied?
Yes, Your Honor. So the elements of felonious assault, he must admit to causing or attempting to cause serious physical harm to another or another's unborn by means of a deadly weapon or dangerous ordinance. Now, with Mr. Wilson expressly denied that he fired at Mr. Raffet. So opposing counsel.
What did he say he fired? He didn't deny that he fired the gun, correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
So where did he say he fired?
He said he fired up in the air, Your Honor. He said he fired out the window, and he said he couldn't help but hit the vehicle.
Out the window or up in the air?
He said both at different times, Your Honor.
Okay.
So but what element is failed?
The knowingly element, Your
knowingly.
Honor.
Knowingly. So knowingly encompasses that you probably will attempt what you're trying to do, regardless of purpose. So even if he was shooting it as a warning shot or actually hit him.
Yes, Your Honor. So the case law on inferring a knowing element or knowing mens rea, State v. Mills, they talk about how the jury must consider the bullet path and the proximity of the impact in order to determine whether the bullet, whether the defendant had a knowingly mens rea. Here, Mr. Wilson expressly denied that the bullet path was as close as the physical evidence suggested. He said that the dent in the vehicle was not from his bullet. He said he couldn't do anything but hit the vehicle. However, his vehicle, they were so close, that was a complete 180-degree field of view, whereas Mr. Raffet would only be a small fraction of that.
The trial court judge in this case basically allowed him to argue self-defense, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
So isn't that a problem in and of itself, to allow the defendant to argue that but not provide the jury with the law regarding self-defense?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. So that goes to, again, the ineffective assistance of counsel. I believe that so by avoiding a self-defense jury instruction, trial counsel basically sidestepped having discussed the elements of self-defense. And with that, he avoided hard questions such as who was at fault, reasonable belief of imminent danger, honest belief of imminent danger, and the use of unreasonable force. And most importantly, by not requesting a self-defense jury instruction, he did not have to acknowledge that Wilson shot at the victim. So the result, if the jury believed Mr. Wilson's testimony, would be acquittal. So it was a sound strategy, and I don't believe that the trial court made a mistake there, Your Honor.
But when he testified that he fired out the window in the general direction of the threat to try to scare the victim in an attempt to back off the aggressor, isn't that tantamount to admitting that he committed felonious assault? How is it not?
He expressly claims that he did not attempt to strike him. Now, it's...
But it's a deadly weapon, so does that really matter?
I believe it does. Under felonious assault, attempt to cause physical harm.
But where in the self-defense statute does it says that the person who wants the self-defense instruction have to intend to cause the crime with which he has been charged?
Yes, Your Honor. In 2901.05b, it states that if at trial, at the trial of a person who is accused of an offense that involved the person's use of force against another, there's evidence that tends to support that the accused used the force in self-defense.
Now, so the force, which in this case is firing the gun.
Your Honor, I believe that the force they are referring to is the offense that involved the person's use of force. That is.
Doesn't say that, though. Doesn't say the offense that caused the use of force. It says involves use of force.
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that the force they're referring to is...
So you're saying at all times, and to be eligible for a self-defense instruction, you have to say, yes, I basically committed the crime of felonious assault or attempted murder or murder, but I did it in self-defense.
Yes, Your Honor, or you did not.
But where does the law say that?
Well, it is an affirmative defense.
It says a person may use deadly force in self-defense where he was not at fault in creating the situation, giving rise to the fray, had a bona fide belief that he was in imminent danger of death or great bodily harm, and the only means to escape such danger was the use of such force. it's the use of, you have to intend to use the force, but you don't have to intend harm. I mean, there's a dissenting opinion in the Court of Appeals said, what this decision stands for is in order to be eligible for self-defense, you have to intend to kill or maim your aggressor. And do, is that what we want the law in Ohio to be for self-defense?
So as a threshold issue for an affirmative defense, yes, Your Honor, yes, the defendant should have to acknowledge the force that they're accused of.
But, and isn't the force in this case firing the gun? And there's no question that Wilson admits to firing the gun.
No, Your Honor. The force he's accused of is attempting to cause physical harm. Now, serious physical harm. Now, aggravated menacing would be if he were to fire the gun and not attempt to hit and have no knowingly mens rea there. Now, that's not what he's accused of, however. So he is basically trying to admit to aggravated menacing, to causing another to believe that he will cause serious physical harm, and then transfer that intent to a knowingly mens rea for felonious assault.
But the example that was used by the Ohio Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, where there's an angry mob that comes to someone's door, and the person who's attempting to defend themselves shoots into the mob and actually kills someone, that's clearly self-defense. But if we keep following what the Second District did, someone who shoots a bullet on the ground and it ricochets into the crowd, or who shoots into the ground to try to scare the mob away, theirs is felonious assault. And the person who actually kills someone is the one that can successfully use self-defense. Is that the way we want the law to be?
Your Honor, I think that the by allowing warning shots to be self-defense or eligible for a self-defense jury instruction, if it's not the crime that they are accused of, that opens the door to people using warning shots when they should not have necessarily done so.
Well, not necessarily, because again, the jury has got to believe or disbelieve that the defendant was entitled to self-defense. It's not like we're saying, oh, he should get the self-defense instruction and be acquitted. It's just get the instruction. There's a whole lot of things that have to take place after that. Was the force he used disproportionate to the harm that he thought would be caused himself? So that, and now, or a jury might not buy his story at all, especially if he goes back and forth. So it doesn't mean he doesn't get convicted of the crime. It's just, is he entitled to the defense? And if indeed a victim, or in this case a defendant, is fearful of being harmed in any way, do you have to think, well, I better fire the shot at the person so I'm entitled to a defense, as opposed to firing it in the air or on the ground? If you're trying to fire a gun to warn someone to get away, to try to protect yourself, do we want people to think of I better fire to hit the guy, or I better kill him, or I better fire in his direction, as opposed to at a gun? And I'm concerned, of course, with just firing a gun out in public like this. It could have not only hit Refit, it could have hit his passenger, it could have hit somebody at a nearby tank or anything. So firing a gun out in public is problematic in and of itself.
Yes, Your Honor. However, I believe that it would promote a policy that would be it would promote people to discharge guns in public much more frequently without having to answer for that. I think by making by reading this statute to mean that it must be.
Well, you're answering for it because you get charged for it and you get tried for it. So you're answering for it.
Potentially, Your Honor. I think people that, if there is a victim that actually got struck with a bullet, there's more likely to be a police report, there's more likely to be a hospital record, there's more likely to be charges in that circumstance. Where people just discharge a firearm, I think that there would be multiple, any number of circumstances where people just don't report it and people get away with it and it doesn't actually promote a self-defense policy.
So should counsel for the defense have asked for, if not self-defense, should they have asked for some kind of other offense such as menacing, which is what you're stating that his explanation of what he did was?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. Menacing is not a lesser included offense.
I understand.
Assault, and he was not charged with aggravated menacing. So if he was, if the jury believed Mr. Wilson's testimony, the result would have been his acquittal. So I think it was a sound strategy.
And can you tell me why, if four people observed what went on, only two were put on the stand?
I don't have an answer for that, Your Honor. I don't know if they were unable to reach them. I don't know, Your Honor.
Thank you.
There are no more questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Ms. Bowling, you still have 3 minutes and 22 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Could you address for me the why you didn't appeal the ineffective assistance of counsel part and what we're supposed to do with it, what we're supposed to do with this case, even if we agree with you?
The appeal to the Second District did include an
right, but the appeal to us, so.
I believe that the appeal did include an ineffective assistance argument, and I know that the state spoke on that in its briefs.
I don't see that in the brief. I'm looking at your brief here. I mean, I see.
It is a secondary. I'm sorry to interrupt you, Your Honor. It is a secondary part of my brief. I speak to the underlying issue of ineffective assistance of counsel. I lead with the issue of the instruction on self-defense because the failure to request that instruction is our opinion is the basis of the ineffectiveness. And so in order to
I guess the problem is the proposition of law that you ask us to take, that we took, if we answer that proposition of law, it doesn't resolve the case. And it doesn't entitle you to a judgment in your favor. Because the only proposition of law you presented was not whether counsel was ineffective, but whether entitled to the instruction or not. But that's a different issue. And so even if we would answer the proposition of law in your favor, you wouldn't win. So I mean, how do we deal with that?
Yeah, and I believe that the brief addresses both and does ask for a finding of ineffectiveness.
Okay, but we only accepted one issue.
And the issue. As it's
the
outlined,
one you ask us to accept.
Yes, Your Honor. As outlined in the brief, was that under these circumstances, Mr. Wilson was entitled to the instruction. And secondary to that, the failure to request that instruction was an ineffective assistance of counsel.
But if he was entitled to the instruction, we would just reverse and remand for a new trial, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, we wouldn't just reverse and remand if he was entitled to the instruction. If counsel didn't ask for it, we'd have to decide first whether it was ineffective assistance not to ask for it, right?
And I believe that those two issues with this particular case cannot be separated from one another. The ineffectiveness is his failure to request that instruction to which he is entitled. And so we're asking this court to determine that under these circumstances that he is entitled to, he or a defendant is entitled to that instruction. And because they are entitled to that instruction, in Mr. Wilson's case, he received ineffective assistance of counsel. The request is that the Second District be reversed on that issue and the case be remanded for further proceedings, being a new trial in this case. And if there are no further questions, that's what I have. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. We will take the matter under advisement and you will receive a decision from the court. Marshall, will you please recess the court?
All rise.